Hello, everyone. Hello, hello. You look so lovely. Thank you for coming. Welcome to the In the Public Interest session. I'm Rashana Gray. I'm very short, which is why I'm on my tippy toes. I'm a member of the program committee here with the festival. We're thrilled to have you with us. Now, a bit of housekeeping. As a free event, we rely on donations, large and humble and well-meaning, to keep the festival free to the public. So if you're enjoying your time with us, please consider making a donation using the handy envelope in your program guides. If you shimmy over to our membership table in the BBF tent and become a member at the $50 level, we will give you a nifty anniversary tote bag. For $150, you will get all of our love and affection and care, and you will get the tote bag filled with great swag like an umbrella and a book by a delightful BBF author and other goodies. Thank you in advance for your support. And now please, please, please welcome Megan Irons, who will introduce the wonderful session.
Thank you, and good afternoon. I'm Megan Irons, and I cover social justice for the Boston Globe, and I'm very happy to be here, and I'm happy to see such a big crowd in this room. We are going to, in my line of work, I cover issues about equity and fairness and injustice, and so I'm really happy to have these two amazing women to kind of flesh out people and public policies and how they're all affected by it. So today's session is extremely exciting. With me today are Beth Macy, whose work, Factory Men, is a New York Times bestseller. She's now putting to light the opioid crisis in her masterful work, Dope Sick, Dealers, Doctors, and the Drug Company That Addicted America. The book takes us right there, in the middle of the pain, in the middle of the hurt, in the middle of the decision-making, and it picks apart how we are all failing at this, although it does offer some hope. Beth was raised in Roanoke, Virginia. She is the author of other bestsellers, True Vine and the aforementioned Factorman. She has won more than a dozen national awards for her reporting, and we welcome you here today.
Thanks so much.
Can you help me? Incidentally, Beth is also in Boston because she's also a Nieman Fellow, and they were having their reunion here this weekend.
Yeah, good timing.
Also with us is Eve Ewing, whose remarkable book, Ghosts in the Schoolyard, Racism and School Closing on Chicago's South Side, is turning heads and sparking conversations. She is a Chicago native, a former Chicago public school teacher, a sociologist, and assistant professor at the University of Chicago, who studies and is really looking into these issues. Her history and firsthand experience and knowledge about the neighborhood are what makes this book all that more powerful. She's also the author of Electric Arches and the co-author of No Blues Memories, The Life of Gwendolyn Brooks. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and The Washington Post. Thank you, Eve, for also being here.
Thank you for having me.
I want to remind you that the books will be on sale, and right after our session, please buy these books. These authors will be available for you to also sign their books. I want to start out by sort of framing the issues. These are two very different topics. We're talking about public education, and we're talking about the drug crisis that has gripped America. And so take us to the beginning of your journeys. Beth, I'll start with you. What got you, I know that you've been covering rural Virginia as a reporter, and you have some histories in your own background, mm-hmm. but talk about how you started on this journey and what led you to this book.
Sure. I was a newspaper reporter, feature writer. I covered family issues, social justice issues in Roanoke, Virginia, which is a city of about 250,000 in the sort of middle of the state. And I had written my first book, Factory Man, about the aftermath of globalization, looking at what happened when the jobs went away in these small Southside Virginia factory towns. And that book came out in 14, and as I was ending it, people were saying a lot of the crime was fueled by was a lot of drug-related crime, and didn't really put it together with some earlier reporting I had did in Roanoke in the suburbs. I did a three-part series on heroin landing in a suburb called Hidden Valley, which was ironically named because it had been going on for a long time and it didn't really make the news until a couple of upper middle class white kids got arrested, and kind of front page story, and people sort of spit their coffee out and said, what, you know, upper middle class white kids are doing heroin. And so What I did was I wrote about the epidemic. I went back in time to a rural community, much like what I'd written about in Factory Man, where the jobs were going away and OxyContin was introduced in 1996. And it was just really a pox on these communities where the jobs were going away and there were lots of workplace injuries. People started diverting them and using them as using the pills as a way to pay their bills. And then when the pills got hard to get in the mid-aughts, in the late early teens, the dealers brought heroin in, knowing that Dope Sick, the title of the book, is really withdrawal, and it portended one hell of a business model. People did not, they say at the end of their journey, they're not doing it to get high, they're doing it not to be dope sick. Mm-hmm. And so I followed the epidemic basically from OxyContin in central Appalachia to heroin in the cities and suburbs, and then more recently to kind of pristine farm towns, because there's nowhere where this crisis isn't right now.
Wow. Penny, what about you? How did you get launched on this?
Yeah, so I grew up in Chicago, as you mentioned, and I attended Chicago public schools my whole life. And at a pretty young age, I became aware of inequality in the school system just by my own observation. I saw the difference in how I was treated versus how my brother was treated versus how other classmates were treated. I attended an elite public high school similar to the exam schools here in Boston. That was a public school that cost $44 million to build. And I knew that at the same time, because I read the printed newspaper back in those days, that there were a group of parents that held a 19-day hunger strike to try to get a school built in the predominantly Mexican-American community of Little Village, a school that had been promised to them, right? And so on the one hand, I'm attending this public high school that's beautiful and has graphing calculators and an Olympic-sized pool, and on the other hand, I'm aware that other people are literally facing death to have a school that was promised to them. Mm-hmm. And so after college, I became a Chicago public school teacher, and I loved being a teacher, and after a while became really fascinated and frustrated with the ways that people outside the classroom, people that I couldn't see, seemed to be persistently making decisions that made our lives bad. And so I set out to kind of try to understand who those people are and where they were. Sort of naively, I imagined them all sitting in a room making nefarious plans around a table. That's not too far from the truth. But I came to graduate school and lived in Boston for 5 years and went to Harvard to try to get the credentials and the background and the understanding to ultimately go back home and figure this out. And while that was happening in 2013, the school closings happened. So in 2013, Chicago closed 50 public schools, which is the largest mass school closure in the nation's history. And it happened while I was here in graduate school. And I became obsessed with trying to understand why it had happened. I became frustrated with people asking me all the time and me not having what I considered a sufficient answer. And so I took, similarly to Beth, I found myself going back in time, because I think in order to answer a lot of these questions, you have to have a historical, contextual perspective. And I ended up kind of getting obsessed with how Chicago public schools and public schools more broadly in these cities became to be how they are, and the relationship between that development and segregation and racism. And so that's how the book started. And I should say that because the school that I don't know if I said this or not, the school where I taught was closed. And so that was part of the shock.
Right. As part of our conversation, we're going to move into some questions about the people making these decisions. But I also want to let you know in the audience that we'll leave some time for you to ask questions as well. Okay, so you start with the description of this plan to shutter all those schools. You just said you were here at grad school. What must have gone through your mind when you realized that some of the schools that were being targeted were schools, at least one of them, what you taught in,
right?
And this was your hometown,
right?
Yes. What was?
Well, what went through my mind was, you know, the justification that was given by the people in charge really played off of a lot of stereotypes about public schools. And so they could say things like, kids are struggling in these schools, they're trapped in these schools are failing. And this is the rhetoric that's often used about public schools in urban places in the United States, in Boston, in Chicago, in Philly, Detroit, and so on. And the thing is that Chicago, much like Boston, is extraordinarily segregated. And for the most part, white families in Chicago have divested from the school. So the city is about a third white, and the school district is about 9% white. Mm-hmm. And those white students that are enrolled are very clustered in, geographically clustered and academically clustered in a comparatively few number of schools. So what that means is that people in charge can make headlines and give press releases saying things like, you know, these kids are trapped in these terrible schools. And for the most part, the people reading who are in power haven't actually been inside the buildings themselves. And so I think, you know, we've had generations of movies like Dangerous Minds and, you know, all these movies that play off of these tropes, The Wire, right, in television. So that what many people envision when they envision a school is this terrible, desperate, urban jungle place. And right away, when I saw my school's name listed in the newspaper, I was transformed. I was there again. And I saw the kids that I saw smiling every day. I saw my colleagues who I respected. I saw my principal who worked really hard. And I thought about all the hours that we put in to create the best possible educational environment for the students that we served. And I realized that it was like somebody talking about you. It was like you're talking about me behind my back. You know, you can't have that.
And Beth, when you started to dig into the drug epidemic here in your hometown, what did you learn about the folks that are dealing with this issue, the people in the emergency room, the families that you met, the people setting policies? What did you learn about that? What did you take away from that?
Mm-hmm. One of the things that was just so striking was the total dip between law enforcement and public health. You know, I followed this one drug ring where they put 84 people in prison on state and federal charges. It was thought to be the biggest heroin ring in Virginia at the time. And, you know, one of the police officers that was investigating that along with ATF agents and prosecutors they would say things like, well, if we caught people and the third time they were arrested, we put them in jail forever, that would end the heroin crisis. And then you would go, and I would interview all these public health experts and people really doing the Lord's work, trying to open a methadone clinic in an area, a rural area that didn't have any access, and they would be the exact opposite. And you saw all the opioid crisis just sort of taking advantage of the fissures in between these two silos. And as one public health professor told me after like a year of watching this madness, he said, you know, the problem is, we are doing things, but nobody's talking to each other, and everybody sees the crisis through the lens of how they get paid. Mm-hmm. So the sheriff doesn't want to give up his money, and so you have these basically volunteers that are trying to divert people from jail and into treatment. But in Virginia, which only recently passed a Medicaid expansion, unlike Massachusetts, these women, mainly, whose children, some had died of overdose, some were luckily in recovery, would go to these Herculean efforts to get people into rehab. And then when they would finally get them in, it would be exactly the wrong kind of rehab. It would be a rehab that wouldn't allow them to have medication-assisted treatment. And so I just saw all these efforts going toward helping these people get help, but oftentimes it was exactly the wrong kind of help, and people falling through the cracks, and basically in many, many states, and again, it's different depending on where you live, in many, many states, we're leaving it to the institution of the American family to deal with the worst drug epidemic in the history of our nation.
Talk about the impact on rural America.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've given maybe 25 talks since the book came out in August. And if I go to a place like Boston or New York, or I usually get like this really engaged readers. I get a lot of, probably there's some docs in the office, maybe some people who work in public health. And they all, you know, are, you know, supportive and they have great questions. But if I go to rural America, where they've been dealing with this since OxyContin came out in 1996, and there is literally not a family in rural, especially in central Appalachia, that hasn't dealt with this. Mm-hmm. And they come up and they just have to tell me that, and it's like, no, it's actually worse than how you describe it. Mm-hmm. And it's just been so much processing of grief to hear these stories and to kind of try to pick the stories out that are going to exemplify where people are falling through the cracks, but also give people a sense of hope. Because I don't want them to just close the book and go, oh, it's hopeless. So try to show people that are making, you know, little mendings in this tapestry filled of holes. I should try to show some of those at the end. But, you know, my good friend is a WBUR health reporter, Martha Biebinger, here in Boston, and she covers opioids almost every day. And she said, you know, honey, you might need to make this seem more hopeful than it really is. Mm. And so just so different, but depending where you are in the country, mm-hmm. It's shocking.
It is pretty shocking. And Eve, just kind of it's toggling to your part of the world, you mentioned that when people talk about troubled schools, they often use really negative terms to describe them. What's the impact of words like failing or troubled or woeful or you name it? The impact it has on the students attending those schools and the impact it has on the community whose parents are sending their children to those schools?
You know, that's such an excellent question because, as you know, if you've watched the news, I've come from a city that the president likes to use as a symbol, as a thinly veiled dog whistle or symbol of everything that's wrong with America. And I think that, but people on both sides of the aisle like to use this language of failing schools. And I think that it's important to remember that if you go into a school and it is really struggling, you might go in and see kids that haven't had a meal in several days, right? Or that the only meal that they've had is the meal they got at school. You might have a kid who, you know, I was in a second grade not too long ago, and there was a little girl with her shoes untied. And I said, why are you walking around with your shoes untied? Let me help you. And she said, oh, these shoes don't tie, you know. And I leaned down and the laces were broken off. This is Chicago in the middle of the winter, right? Mm. So this child doesn't have basic functional schools, shoes, and all of the things that you see that get so easily labeled as failure are the result of that kind of struggle that is systematically created and reinforced. And public schools become one of the few last institutions in a country that is steadily eroding any kind of public support, and that consistently judges people for being poor, that expects poor people to earn through virtuous action any sort of social support. Schools are one of the few places where we still say, we'll take everybody, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that means you have kids who've been homeless for a while, you have kids whose parents don't have employment, you have kids who themselves or their parents are struggling with mental health issues, who don't have a good way to get to school in the morning because of inadequate transportation, who may not have safe and affordable housing, who may be dealing with substance abuse issues. Mm-hmm. These are all of our country's issues that come to bear on these little people who by no fault of their own now have to bear the weight of the world on their shoulders. And so, yeah, some of them are really struggling. But to call that a failure is to redirect the true failure, which is the failure of the American moral imagination to say it's our responsibility to provide for every child. Mm-hmm. And that is the failure. And, you know, many of us as people of color know what it's like to walk around and have people put labels on you, right? And those are things that kids internalize, that they hear, and that they understand. When I left Chicago Public Schools to go to graduate school, one of my students, a little fourth grader, came and hugged me around the shins and was like, Miss E, why are you leaving? And one of my students, an eighth grader, patted her on the shoulder and said, Miss E is going to fix all the terrible things about our school that we always complain about, because we know CPS isn't good. And I was like, right, but they internalize these things.
Right.
And so I just, of all the people who, there is failure involved, but it's not the kids who are failing.
Hmm. That's very fascinating. Oh, all right.
Yeah, shout out to my poets in the audience.
You both talk about poverty, and in Chicago's case, race. The head of the Chicago school system is a black woman.
She was, yes. She's in prison now.
She's
yes,
in prison yes. now. Whoa, there you go.
By the
there
book.
There you
read
go.
All
yes. Rahm Emanuel is a progressive. Why are they so disconnected from the people that they're serving? And you could relate in some ways, I think, to the drug issues and tackling the drug issues and the different groups of people that aren't taking responsibility for where we are today. Why is there such a disconnect? Can you pinpoint what it is in your individual cases? To both of you, and either one can go first.
Sure. Well, Rahm Emanuel is a Democrat. He's not a progressive. I think that's an important distinction. He's a member of the Democratic Party. In Chicago, we have pretty much a one-party system, actually. So Democrats are up to all kinds of foul business. And Barbara Burr Bennett, as you point out, who was the superintendent, or actually in Chicago we call the superintendent the CEO, if you want a case study in how kind of market language has infiltrated our public school system. So Barbara Burr Bennett was a black woman. She was indicted on federal charges of bribery, unrelated to the things in the book. She was taking bribes in exchange for assigning very lucrative professional development contracts, and snitched on herself in an email where she uttered the immortal words, "I have casinos to visit and tuition to pay."
Uh-oh.
So if you're going to be fraudulent, just don't email people outlining your... That's what payphones are for. You got to do it old school. But, you know, as we saw in the last couple of weeks in America, being a member of an oppressed group doesn't mean that you were exempt from reinforcing that oppression. We saw a lot of patriarchal, misogynistic behavior from a lot of women in high places in the last month, right? Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, Barbara Bird Bennett she was kind of acting as an actor of white supremacy and racism. Mm-hmm. It's also convenient that part of what's happened in the last few decades and the way racism operates differently is it's not a coincidence that they have a black woman doing this work, right? It's not a coincidence that you find somebody because what happened was that when people started saying the school closings were racist, Rahm Emanuel came out and said, that is offensive to her. Mm-hmm. How can you say that to her as a woman of color, right? And so this amazing Karl Rovian level pivoting of language in order to effectively reappropriate the language of the civil rights movement, the language of social justice, to enact policies that themselves are mm-hmm. racist.
Well, that's interesting. As you were talking, I was thinking about the crack epidemic and how that was framed, and in comparison to the opioid epidemic, where there's so much empathy
absolutely.
For the victims. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, so when the opioid crisis happens, it begins in central Appalachia. Unlike most other epidemics, which has started in the cities, this starts in the rural hinterlands. And nobody really paid attention to it because it was, you know, people in politically unimportant places where their media outlets were declining. And so the experts actually believe African Americans were protected from the painkiller problem because of old-fashioned racism. Their doctors didn't trust them to take them correctly, right? So at the beginning, you saw this not hitting African Americans as much, but now that it's gone to a heroin and a fentanyl problem, mm-hmm. More recent data show that actually the highest overdose death rates are coming out of inner cities, Chicago, largely among middle-aged African American men who are getting out of prison at six times the rate of white men and are getting no treatment when they're in prison. And so they're coming out and they're going back to perhaps the dose they used before, and they are coming into contact with fentanyl and overdosing. As the saying goes, if it's raining in the white community, it's a tsunami in the black community. Mm-hmm. And so they are getting the most stepped on with fentanyl, and they're also the least likely to call 911 because of trust issues mm-hmm. and bad policing policies.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask one more question, and then we'll bring the audience into the conversation. And just, you were telling me earlier about where you grew up, and talk about that and how it informed your research and writing and the understanding of the people you chronicle in this book.
Sure. And if it's okay, I'll read a very short passage that sort of deals with that, too. Yeah. So I grew up, I was the first in my family to go to college. My dad was, there's no nice ways to say this, so I'm just going to say it. He was kind of the town drunk. I lived in a small town in Ohio. My mom basically held the family together, and I went to college solely on Pell Grants, back at a time in the early 80s when it was possible for a promising poor kid to go to college. I mean, I even got money back to pay to buy my books. And I think that that was the most important, like, thing that happened to me, like, just having this experience of where, you know, you get these opportunities. And so, so as I was working on this book, it brought up a lot of times when I didn't feel safe as a child, and I realized the only way I was going to be able to get through it was to focus on the people who were fighting back. My friend said, remember Mr. Rogers said, find the helpers. So I did that. I wrote about a doctor who's fighting Purdue Pharma at the very beginning. I wrote about these women that are trying to get treatment. I wrote about even an ATF agent who's trying to put a dealer in jail. But mostly I followed these people as they were not being able to get life-saving treatment. Mm. One Roanoke woman was so desperate to avoid relapse that she prepared for an upcoming 2-week jail stint by stuffing a vial of Suboxone strips inside her vagina, knowing local jails didn't allow medication-assisted treatment. Quote, then in the middle of the night, she pulled the bottle out, took one, then quickly put it back, said her doctor, Jen Wells, who treats indigent pregnant women before and after delivery. That patient's continued recovery, she said, quote, speaks to the fact that MAT works and that patients will go to any length not to relapse. They know what they need. But the divide between MAT opponents and proponents only deepened as I followed the travails of the Hope Initiative and users like Tess Henry, who's the young woman that I've follow for most of the book. While treatment providers, police, and family members were arguing about the best way forward, lives hung perilously in the balance. It was hard being Tess. After 4 NA meetings, she stopped wanting to go, often texting me just as I was leaving to pick her up. The baby was sleeping, or she was too tired because he'd kept her awake the night before. His father was in jail after an alcohol-related arrest, and though his mother stepped in to babysit, she was planning to move to North Carolina and hinted that she wanted to take her grandson with her. Having grown up in an alcoholic household, I knew what it felt like to live on the periphery of addiction, the potential danger of being neglected, taken advantage of, or even raged against. And being with Tess sometimes brought up memories of a much darker time. I worried about her son and felt sorry for him. There were instances when journalistic boundaries blurred, such as the night Tess texted me from an unknown location with a barely readable text that said, "Can you please come get me?" I was in the middle of organizing taxes with the help of my spreadsheet whiz niece and didn't see the text immediately. An hour later, I weighed what to do, talked to my husband, and ultimately forwarded Tess's plea to both these women who were trying to help her. The next time I saw Tess, neither of us brought it up.
Hmm. Wow, that's really powerful. Eve, do you have a passage you want to read?
Sure. So we've been talking a lot about schools, but the book is even if you don't know anything about schools, it's partially just about race and racism. So I'm going to read a little bit about that. Our culture has an odd relationship with race. It structures every aspect of American social life, but in ways that can often seem invisible and undetected. Like an electrical current running through water, race has a way of filling space even as it remains invisible. In the news and media, we talk about it constantly, but in our everyday lives, many people are uncomfortable discussing race and racism, especially with people from different backgrounds. Much of this book explores the role of race in the school closure decisions, but before we can understand whether school closings are racist, we have to understand what racism is, and those who support or oppose school closings seem to disagree on that front. For many, the word racism conjures up images from history. Whites-only signs on water fountains, burning crosses, angry mobs screaming at the Little Rock Nine or at Ruby Bridges. Others may recognize racism in the present, but only when it's overt. The harsh words of those who would see all Muslims banned from the United States, or Donald Trump referring to Mexican people as criminals and rapists. But in the decades since Jim Crow, racism has become less obviously bound to formal institutions and laws, making it more difficult to identify. Instead, we see laissez-faire racism, a form of discrimination that does not depend on the law, but instead relies on the market and informal racial bias to recreate and, in some instances, sharply worsen structured racial inequality. We might think of this form of racism as being like a mechanical toy. You wind it up and it goes off on its own. In the United States, the racist structures that were inscribed in law generations ago, when separate but equal was perfectly legal, established the framework for the way our society currently functions. Often when people talk about racism, they're using the term to refer to a set of ideas or personal values. In their view, racism is a disease that afflicts some individuals and causes them to discriminate against others because of the way they look. This version of racism is familiar from everyday discourse. We hear people say things like, "I have no racism in my heart," or "How can I be racist? My best friend is black." This characterization views racism as something that lives in an individual, that has to do with one's beliefs and opinions. It's often complemented by the idea of colorblindness, exemplified by the common claim that, "I don't see race," or "Everyone is the same to me. I don't care if they're black, white, red, yellow, green, or polka dot." Always the polka dot. Not sure why. No polka dot people. Those who use such language are making several implicit claims. "I'm not a racist. Racism means seeing people differently and treating them differently. I see everyone the same." This perspective locates racism within individuals and what we see. It suggests that even to acknowledge difference is a form of racism. That creates a conflict, since those harmed by racism require an acknowledgement of our status in order to have a conversation about injustice. For example, to talk about the legacy of slavery, the genocide of indigenous people, or the internment of Japanese Americans, you need to admit that we are, in fact, not all the same. For sociologists, as well as for many activists and others, it's more accurate to think of racism as a set of structures, systems in the fabric of American society. Through this lens, what is in one's heart does not matter. Rather, the question becomes how our society follows a pattern, churning out different outcomes for different people in a way linked to race. One metaphor we can use to understand this is riding a horse. Many people believe racism is like a skilled equestrian's choosing through decisions and commands to go faster or slower, to jump a fence or avoid an obstacle, or follow a certain route or not. However, racism is more like a merry-go-round. You may be going up, down, and around, and you might feel like you're riding a horse, but the machine is functioning with or without you. From this point, we can see acts of racism not as the result of individuals being socially deviant, but as perfectly normal and predictable because they are built into the social system. Put simply, racism is as American as apple pie. Mm.
That's something to ponder.
Some people are clapping, some are like, "I don't know. I don't know."
Does anybody have any questions? We'd love to hear from you. Yes, please.
Beth, did you read Hillbilly Elegy?
I did. Yeah, and when I first started going down to Lee County into central Appalachia, which is about 4 hours from my home, there wasn't a person there who liked it. I mean, if you were a doctor working in this area or an activist, you hated that book because they felt like, A, he wasn't even a real hillbilly because he was from Ohio, and B, he was basically just spouting this pull yourself up from the bootstraps philosophy with no real understanding of that we don't all start out at the same level, mm-hmm. right? And that it was the coal executives that no understanding of the historical way that they took the property away from the people, and then the rapacious pharmaceutical companies came in and told these lies that they were found to be a criminal misbranding of the product by saying it wasn't addictive when it was. So they were they're pretty ticked off in Appalachia about that book.
Oh yeah. I know that Hillbilly Elegy is Southwest Ohio. But...
Yeah. Is there another question here? Yes, please. Do you mind just saying, tell us who you are?
Sure. Elisa Harris. And I actually worked at a national network of drug treatment facilities a long time ago. But I'm very curious to hear more about what you see with the big picture of the treatment that's available, mm-hmm. the quality of it, the availability of it, the funding of it, and the cost of it, and whether if you think it's effective or not.
In terms of rehab treatments? Okay, my main concern with rehab treatments is more than half of rehab centers in America don't allow medication-assisted treatment, which study after study shows is the best way to prevent relapse and overdose deaths. There are only 3% of facilities offer all three kinds, methadone, naltrexone, and buprenorphine or suboxone. And the reason a lot of treatment centers don't is because that whole addiction science sort of grew up with the 12-step philosophy front and center. And there's a lot of, I talk about this a lot in the book, just people being guided by abstinence only. And, you know, mainly they're not standardized the way they should be. So you'll see families like second mortgage their house or beg their grandparents for money for like $30,000 to send their kid away for a month. And when they get out, they relapse. They have nothing to protect them. And there they are in the statistics again. But, you know, the latest Congress just approved an opioid bill, was the one rare bipartisan bill, $8.5 billion. Experts think it's going to take $60 to $80 billion over the next 10 years in order to get addiction treatment away from this unregulated hodgepodge abstinence-only model and into our healthcare system. And that's a lot of money, but we're looking at a cost of $1 trillion in lost productivity, foster care, you know, all kinds of healthcare costs because of this. So we're going to pay for it one way or another, and we're really looking at a tsunami of hepatitis C if we don't get our arms around this. The three states that have shown the most progress with slight turndowns of overdose deaths are Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and Vermont, and they are doing things like if you overdose and you end up at the ER, they're putting you directly into a buprenorphine program. They have syringe exchange programs, but again, in places like where I live, this is not yet happening. Right. So it's.
There's a question in the back, and we'll take you in the front, and then you in the back.
Hi, my name is Emily. I'm a student at Tufts University. And I was curious if you guys could speak about navigating the lines between being a reporter and a researcher, but also being someone that could empathize and befriend with the people that you were working with. Thanks.
That's a great question.
That is
so,
a great question.
I don't believe in objectivity. I don't think that that's a thing. I think that, I mean, if you want to get wonky about it, I come from a phenomenological tradition, which means that all different people have a different understanding of what truth is. Now, that can sound like a cop-out, but actually I think that a lot of times people whose work pretends to be objective more often just have the privilege of having their point of view, which is still a point of view, recognized and considered objective by the rest of the world, right? What I try to do is be very forthright about the perspectives that I do bring to my work, both with the people that I'm talking to and interacting with, and also in my writing. So I say in my writing, my school closed. I was sad about that. I am also Black. I am also from Chicago. I am also a person who was a public school teacher. Those are all things that I bring into my work, and I kind of leave it to the reader for you to say, okay, well, I can see how her perspective from here influences the way she thinks about this. And I trust my reader to do that work, and my job is to be transparent about it. I also think that I come from a long research tradition of people who did not feel like they had to conceal the fact that they were doing their research because they cared about the world. And so that goes all the way back to W.E.B. Du Bois and Zora Neale Hurston and Ida B. Wells, right? Ida B. Wells wasn't saying, I'm going to do this study of how many people are being lynched because it's fascinating data. She did it because she wanted to change the world and save people's lives, right? And I think that's something that I'm very proud of and a tradition I try to live up to.
I have a similar philosophy. One thing I like about writing books is you get to spend longer lengths of period and cover, you know, 2 decades in this case. Mm-hmm. And as a newspaper journalist, you're really not supposed to put yourself in. Mm-hmm. But I think the reader deserves to know that I grew up in a household with addiction in it. And then when I'm approaching the people that I want to follow, like, for instance, the young woman Tess that I spent probably the most time with, I said, I'm going to be writing a book about the heroin epidemic. I'd like to see, I just tried to be really transparent. I'd like to follow you. I'd like to check in with you every week or so. I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm sure I'll learn things by watching your journey. And I will never lie to you. I will always tell you kind of what I'm doing as I learn more about what the book is about. At the beginning, I didn't know. I was just like kind of casting my net wide. I didn't know if she'd be in it. And then as it went along, I just tried to always kind of let her know where the book was, to the point of near the end of the book, I had read from some of it at a book reading, and this was right before she passed away. She chimed in, I helped make that book. And, you know, there's a feature writer in the 90s that when I was really studying all this and trying to get better, I used to love what he wrote. He was a Washington Post magazine writer named Walt Harrington. And he said about this journalistic boundaries thing, and I'm sure you've dealt with this a lot. Yeah. He said, you're not getting close enough to somebody unless you're right at that line.
You are at that line.
Yeah. And if you're not struggling with what to include or what not to include, you haven't gotten to that line yet. And I said, well, how do you know that you're ready to write? How do you know your research is done? He said, I know my research is done on a story when I start dreaming about the people. And I thought that was really the case.
I can definitely relate to that, because there was a time when I spent a whole year looking at this family who had been caught up in violence and had to go with them as they were going through the trial of the murderers of their son. That was the only report, the only person besides a daughter that was in the court with them. So they totally identified with me. And when the verdict was read, I remember standing in the hallway, and the mom just walked up to me and just buried her head in my neck and bawled. And I couldn't help it. I was crying with her because I had walked with her through that entire journey. And you do try to create that line. You go close, so close to it, but you become so wrapped up, especially when you're spending so much time with people in the journeys that they're sharing with you, and the strength and bravery that it takes to allow us to sort of watch what they're going through.
But you have to be a person first, right?
You do. Yes. Well,
I mean, you have to cry with them. You have to, you just have to approach it from that perspective, I think.
Yep, exactly. Yes, we have a few more questions. Great.
Hi, my name is Amy Beckwith, and I just was wondering about Beth's prediction on the many suits that have been brought against Purdue Pharma, and what those funds may they go toward the recovery efforts.
Right. So in 2007, Purdue admitted that it had criminally misbranded the drug, and it was fined $634 million. But none of that money went to treatment; it all went to law enforcement, And then Purdue and other opioid makers poured $880 million between that time and 2015 into lobbying and political campaigns. So when you're voting, like, see who's paying for those campaigns. I'm hopeful that there's more than 1,000 lawsuits that a Cleveland judge is overseeing. He says he means to make meaningful treatment. These are cities, counties, states, Native American tribes suing opioid makers and distributors. And, during their first hearing in January, he said X number of people have died just since we've been sitting here talking about this. Massachusetts, the attorney general is now suing the Sackler family. It's a privately held company owned by the Sacklers. And that's a new strategy as well. So I'm hopeful that this time there will be treatment where there was not before.
This lady right there. Oh, there are a couple of questions in the back.
Yep. Hi, my name is RP. I work at an alternative high school here in Boston, and I'm just, we also are working with students who come from really extreme trauma backgrounds, and I'm wondering what you both think about trauma and mental health in this country and how it feeds into some of the issues that you've been writing about.
Great. Can I ask what school you work at?
Boston Day and Evening.
Okay, great. I do a lot of poetry organizing in Boston, so you have some good poets at your school. I think that so much of the trauma that our young people bring into schools every single day is normalized, is not even considered or labeled as trauma, is not even considered or labeled as PTSD. And because of that, it's hard to even begin a conversation about healing. In Chicago, right around the same time that he oversaw the closure of the schools, Rahm Emanuel also closed mental health clinics across the city, which didn't get as many headlines. But a lot of people have been fighting and organizing against that. And this interacts with policing as well. So Quintonio LeGreer, who was a young man who was shot and killed by police, was having a mental health episode. He was manic on his lawn. His neighbor came down to try to help him, and they called 911, and the police came and killed him and his neighbor, right? And her name was Betty Jones, elderly woman living in his building trying to assist him during a crisis. And so all of these things, policing, schooling, mental health, are all the same thing. One of the students that I taught, who I taught in middle school, she went on to attend high school with Hadia Pendleton, who was the 15-year-old who famously marched in the marching band, her school's band, at Barack Obama's inauguration, and came home and shortly thereafter was shot and killed in a park at 15 years old. And my student, who had been her classmate, was saying, "I'm afraid that I'm going to die. I'm afraid that this is going to happen to me," right? That's trauma. That's trauma. And I think that until we can start saying we have a city, a country of children that are hurting, that are bearing the trauma of going to bed hungry, of losing people in front of them, of seeing their parents deal with mental health issues and struggle, because we know from research that parents who go through, for example, profound cycles of depression, that impacts their kids, right? We have to name those things, and we have to arm those kids with the resources that they need. And, you know, during the last mayoral election, one of the candidates was saying, you know, "I want 10,000 police on the street." And I want 10,000 mental health workers on the street. I want 10,000 social workers. I want 10,000 substance abuse counselors and 10,000 mental health workers that are going to refer people into meaningful rehab. I want 10,000 people to help parents find jobs and make sure that their kids have a place to sleep at night. So I think we need to start having a real conversation in this country about where our resources go. I'll stop ranting about this in a second, but the last thing I'll say is that If you're familiar with my work, you know that I talk a lot about the police and prisons, right? And Laquan McDonald, as you know, if you've seen in the national news, the police officer who shot him last week was convicted, which was the first time that that's happened in half a century. And Laquan McDonald was also our student, right? He was also our kid. And so he was failed by the educational system and by many of the adults around him long before he was shot dead with 16 bullets in the street. But the city paid $5 million in a settlement to his mother before the murder became public. And the city of Chicago has paid something like $500 million out to in police settlements, right? And so when it comes to, and the reason this is related to schools, because when I complain about schools, is that people say we don't have no money, right? So where is the money going? Mm-hmm. And I think that we need to have that civic conversation as citizens.
Good point.
I don't think I can top that answer.
Hi, I'm Alex. I'm from Bristol, Tennessee, which is just down the interstate. Sure, yeah. Roanoke. First, thank you for saying Appalachia correctly. I've had to teach a lot of people. And I moved up here for graduate school in public health and nutrition. And I noticed I have been in a family with some opioid issues, and I had to leave that situation eventually and came here. And so I have a question for Eve, too, in terms of, you know, leaving a situation and wondering if you're doing the right thing by, like, wanting to make the world better on, like, a bigger stage and then maybe not, like, kind of abandoning the situation you're in. But also for Beth, I just wondered if you saw any overlap between, like, chronic illness and some of these lifestyle-related diseases, like cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and sort of the loss of autonomy that comes from that, that's so wrapped up in poverty and opioid addiction as well, just sort of the feeling kind of hopeless in so many ways. The healthcare system has, you know, failed people in rural areas and really in cities too, but so kind of like two questions.
Who wants to go first? I'll start. Yeah.
So yeah, absolutely. The Deaton and Case study that was like such a bombshell, I think, in 2015, the deaths of despair, you see that over and over in Appalachia. I was thinking as you were talking about the young boy I had met, his teacher, she asked him what he wanted to be when he grew up from Kentucky, and he said, a drawer. And she said, an artist? And, no, I want to be somebody who draws disability. It was the only thing he could imagine for himself because his
like
that
who
was
receives disability.
Yes, that's what how his parents and his grandparents. And so you have disability rates. I mean, in this county that I profile, 58% of working age men are unemployed, many of them on disability. And so I applaud you for making a difference and putting yourself first. I hear that over and over. Should I stay and should I help Appalachia get better? Or in order to save myself, do I have to go? And I sort of made a similar decision when I left my small town in Ohio. I don't think I'd be who I am today. I think I might be somebody like the people I write about in my book. So I think you have to do what's best for you. And sometimes you maybe can't help those people that you were with growing up, but maybe you can help somebody else. And so I applaud you for that.
Lady in the white shirt has been at.
Yeah, I was going to say. You've been waiting.
Sorry. No problem. Thank you, thank you. Yes, thank you, ladies, for being here today. And this question is directed to Ms. Ewing. So thank you, Ms. Ewing. I have your poetry book.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
And I'm also a poet and a writer and an educator. I teach for the Boston Public Schools. My name is Shirley, by the way. And I wanted to ask you specifically, as you discussed in your book, and here, you know, there are issues within the Chicago public school system, as many major cities have issues, and that's definitely the case here in the Boston public school system. But in every urban sector, the districts have points of light where things are working for the betterment of students of color. And I'm curious as to, you know, your thoughts on places within the school system or maybe alternative school systems within CPS that are working for students of color and how we might be able to take some of their ideas to help our children here in Boston.
Oh, what a great question. So when I lived here, I had the pleasure of interacting with BPS in different ways, mostly through arts stuff. And I think that Chicago has a lot to learn from. I think CPS has a lot to learn from BPS, quite frankly. Although there is this question of scale, CPS just serves way, way, way more students. But I think in terms of points of light, there are so many. There are so many educators, as you know yourself being one, that do so much with so little. And I think that oftentimes we overlook those points of success because we still have this national narrative around standardized testing. And oftentimes, going back to the question about failing schools, what that means is a shorthand for failing at tests, right? And that kind of single-mindedness can cause us to miss a lot of good things that are happening. So my colleagues at the Consortium for Chicago School Research did a study last year that barely got any press, where they found that the selective enrollment schools, like the equivalent of the exam schools, like the type of school that I went to, their students were leaving with very few academic gains when they graduated. And the struggling schools, those students were leaving with very few academic gains. And the schools that were actually doing the most were this kind of middle tier of schools where students come in, they're kind of struggling, there are a lot of basic competencies that they don't have yet, and educators work really, really, really hard, and those kids graduate leaps and bounds above and beyond where they started, but they don't get the same credit, prestige, or attention for it as the selective schools who have all these kids going to elite colleges and actually didn't really do anything additive with them academically, right? It's really easy to have a great school if you select on the criterion of kids who test really well. I used to get in big Facebook fights with my fellow alumni because every year the newspaper would say Northside College Prep is the number one school in the state, and they'd be sharing this article. And I was like, you guys, it's the number number one school because they select kids based on their test scores, and the ranking is just test scores. It's like if I recruited a track team and said, you have to run a 5-minute mile. I'm like, my team is the fastest. Like, of course, duh, right? And so, but the way that we think about schools and meritocracy and all that stuff keeps us from seeing those victories that often happen in the middle, where some of those kids are not necessarily going to be coming to Brown or going to Stanford or whatever, but they have gotten a lot out of their education, and those educators deserve our attention. Shout out to the person earlier coming from an alternative school, right? I mean, that those are the kinds of places that sometimes get the least recognition where folks are working the hardest.
We don't have that much time
Thank you.
Left, and I do want Beth to talk about the locket that you have.
Oh, yeah.
I wanted to ask you about that, and I forgot. So can you end with that and end on a hopeful note as well?
Yeah, so Tess Henry, the young woman I follow for the last third of the book, was brutally murdered after sort of failing out of a rehab center, abstinence only in Nevada, and was operating in a world of criminal prostitution and drug gangs. And they found her body on Christmas Eve at the bottom of a dumpster. Another addicted person foraging for cans found her body. And so her mother and I, who had gotten very close, she gave me this locket. Tess had been trying so hard to get home to get her son, custody of her son back, and this was Tess's favorite poem. She had been a published poet in high school, and it's E.E. Cummings' poem that has the line, I carry your heart in my heart.
Oh, I love that poem. I carry your heart with you, with me. I carry it in my heart.
Yeah. So, and then the tree of life is was how they identified her. She had a tree of life tattoo on her shoulder. So I keep Tess on one side with the rescue dogs, and I keep James Baldwin on the other, because James Baldwin said, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's what Tess would want us to take from this book. She wanted me to see how hard it was for her, how she had been overprescribed at an urgent care center, and how what we need more than anything to solve the opioid crisis is a system of urgent care for the addicted. Mm-hmm. So thank you all.
Thank you.
I love your topic.
Thank you. Thank you. We read that poem at my wedding. I love that poem.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
deserve it. Deserve it.
Lift every voice.
I want to thank. Yeah.